A warning, this story touches on sensitive issues and may not be suitable for all listeners. I'm Andy Richards, a journalist from the Birmingham Mail, and this is the final episode in the podcast series The Lonely Death of Janet Parker, marking the 40th anniversary of the last person in the world to die from smallpox. Just over 12 months after the outbreak, and some 8 months after the shooter report, came the court case, when the University of Birmingham were prosecuted for a health and safety breach. The case was heard by Birmingham magistrates. The university was defended by Brian Escott Cox QC. The prosecution was reliant on trying to prove in as far as possible that the virus had travelled via air ducting from the professor's laboratory to a room where Mrs. Parker was working and she was infected in that way. But Mr. Escott Cox persuaded magistrates that for this to have happened, well, the odds against it were many, many thousands, if not millions, to one. And that smallpox was only passed on from one person to another by people who were less than 10 inches apart.
I'm afraid you must prepare yourselves for a shock. I hoped I might be wrong, but I'm sorry to say Dr. Williams agrees with me. It's smallpox, I'm afraid.
Smallpox? But that's impossible.
Unlikely, but not impossible.
How can she have got smallpox?
Just what we've got to try to find out.
On behalf of the prosecution, the HSE hired junior barrister Colin Colston, a cheaper option, and perhaps an uneven match for the esteemed Escott Cox and his assistant Coleman Tracy. Colin Colston opened the proceedings with a long and dry description of the laboratory and its facilities, complete with 16 photos. New Scientist journalist Lawrence McGinty reported that by the end of day one, things weren't looking good for the HSE because Colston had, quote, bored the pants off the magistrates. Mark Pallon again.
There were a number of issues raised in the courtroom about, well, did they follow their own rules about this or that or the other? And the experts said, well, you know, these rules, you can argue about the rules, and none of them are such that if you don't follow that particular rule, you are clearly and legally in breach of guidelines, placing people's lives at risk or health at risk. Things like, you know, do you change a lab coat? How often do you change a lab coat? The argument was raised, well, every time you change a lab coat, you're going to throw all the material that's on the lab coat into the air. You know, if there's particles that have settled on the lab coat and you take it off, and you know, and actually that isn't necessarily a good thing to keep changing your lab coat. There are arguments about, well, is it best to work inside a safety cabinet or not? You become a lot more clumsy when you're doing things inside a safety cabinet. The argument is that perhaps you become more likely to make a mistake. It's more likely something will go wrong when you're doing things in an awkward kind of way than if you're doing something that seems more natural. And so there's kind of, you know, there's always trade-offs in risk in any kind of procedure. All that was discussed in the court case, and there was no evidence that there were any serious lapses in procedure. There was no occasion that was recognised, no incident that said, oh, that could have accounted for it. They drew a blank on what led to this particular incident.
One of the expert witnesses for the defence, Professor Kevin McCarthy, suggested that, given the rate of work carried out in the lab, it would have taken 20,000 years before a single particle would have reached the room where Janet had worked.
It was clear to me before the case ever started that we were going to be able to prove absolutely beyond any question of doubt whatever that airborne infection of smallpox cannot take place other than between two people who are face to face less than 10 inches apart. If the prosecution had known that in advance, they might have approached this case completely differently. But as it was, in Mr. Colston's opening speech, he portrayed a picture of smallpox spores swirling round the laboratory, the corridors and the ducts, like hayseeds in August. whereas we know that absolutely nothing of the sort was possible or did take place. So they were completely misled. How and why, I don't know. And it must have been a devastating shock to their case when the evidence proved beyond any peradventure that such a thing couldn't take place.
It was the crucial testimony of Keith Dumble that sealed the deal for the defence, especially as he had been asked to appear as a prosecution witness for the HSE. At the time, he was probably the world's leading expert on smallpox, and he commanded the respect of the courtroom.
He had carried out experiments in a hospital ward in Madras, which was full of smallpox sufferers, and he could not get a smallpox reading of any description anywhere in that ward other than putting the instrument directly in front of the face of one of the sufferers. He said, apart from that, that ward was completely free of smallpox. Evidence of that sort is quite devastating. And, of course, it was backed by all three experts saying if smallpox could be airborne and long-distance contagious, it would never have been wiped out of the world. It was only wiped out because of its limitations.
On the stand, Dumble refuted any suggestion that the virus had spread through the air duct. He undermined the findings of the Shooter report and defended Henry Bedson's work. In fact, he told the court that his own lab had also undergone a safety inspection and passed, despite having very similar faults to Henry's. Under cross-examination, he suggested that direct personal contact was a far more likely cause of the infection. A verdict of not guilty was returned. Despite being vindicated in court, Hugh Pennington thinks the University of Birmingham aren't too happy about this black mark on their reputation.
Well, that's always been my impression. They just don't want to talk about it. I don't suppose you could say it was a moment of glory in their history or anything like that. To be cynical, I suppose you could say that like every university, like all universities, when the universities write their histories, they're always celebratory. And they hardly ever say anything about any kind of unpleasantness that happened on their premises. But that's just the nature of institutions. Perhaps you could say it's time the University of Birmingham came to terms with the fact that it will forever be in the history books of smallpox as the place where the last virus to escape and infect somebody, well, the last virus to infect somebody, and unfortunately the last person to die from smallpox, was an employee of the university, and clearly the virus that infected the person was being worked on at the university. How the two connected is a little bit more difficult to say, but it was a university issue. You know, that's history. You can't get around that. There was nobody who was evading things, there was nobody making things up, there was nobody committing anything criminal, or anything. It was almost a civil kind of issue, highly unusual case, and so on. And steps had been taken to minimise the risk. Unfortunately, they didn't minimise it as low as could have been done, and certainly the risk ended in a fatality. We've got two fatalities, really, because Henry was a victim of the smallpox, just as, in a sense, just as much as Mrs. Parker was. So, you know, bad. But when you read about what the university says about itself, it doesn't say anything about that. Not surprisingly. It's very good work, excellent university, some fantastic research down there, big discoveries, Nobel Prizes, blah. Don't talk about smallpox.
Andy Richards from the Birmingham Mail.
I wanted to talk to the University of Birmingham about what had happened in 1978, and I tried for several weeks to get someone to talk to me. Looking back at Birmingham Mail cuttings, I was aware that there'd been an apparent reluctance in the past on behalf of the university to talk about the issue. So, when Professor David Adams, who is head of the College of Medical and Dental Sciences at the university, agreed to speak to me, I was very pleased. He spoke at some length about the sadness that the university feels about the tragedy that befell Janet Parker and that of Professor Bedson. Indeed, he points out that in Professor Bedson's case it was a double blow because his reputation had been tarnished. He also talked about the relief that the university felt at being cleared of any breach of any rules or regulations, and to have responded rapidly when the incident happened. but he was quite candid. He says that it's not something that you want to be known for, having the last smallpox case in the world. It's not the legacy that you want. So I asked the professor specifically about room EG34B and what it was used for nowadays. And he told me, the room is not hugely different. There have been no major structural changes in that part of the building, but it's not been mothballed. We're tight on space. It's not sealed off in any way, and it's part of the clinical immunology service and used in the normal way. He also said, the university doesn't have anything to hide, and wouldn't want to hide anything about this extraordinary but very sad part of its history. It would welcome any subsequent facts which emerged, shedding new light on the mystery.
After the verdict was delivered, Brian Escott-Cox and his junior, Coleman Tracy, now Lord Justice Tracy, enjoyed a low-key celebratory lunch. Since then, he has had plenty of time to formulate his own opinion over what happened.
Well, I have my own personal views about this. I need, I think, to be very careful how I express them, because part of it is factual and inferences which might be drawn from proven facts, and the other is probably little more than gossip. The factually proven one and the inferences, that it seems unhappily inevitable that once it has been proved beyond any question of doubt that the smallpox could not have escaped from the laboratory and gone to Janet Parker, the overwhelming inference is that Janet Parker must in some way or other have come to the smallpox. How that came about, I don't know. We shall never know. But I think that from those facts, it is an inevitable inference, and nothing else would really stands up to any common sense view. There were some rumours circulating at the time, and I emphasise that they were only rumours, that Janet Parker used to visit her colleagues in the medical school at about this time of year, as she was a photographer and able to supply them with any photographic needs they might need for their summer holidays. Whether that might possibly have led her to tap on the outer laboratory door or do any of the sort is pure speculation, and it's speculation of a route down which I am not going to go. But I emphasise that even the question of her visiting colleagues and the photographic materials was based only on rumour gathered as circulating in the medical school at about the time of her death. Nobody has ever come forward and supported that with a statement of any kind or description.
Looking back in later years, Keith Dumble formulated his own theory on how Janet might have contracted the virus. Mark Pallon spoke with him.
It was clear that he had thought about these issues for a long time. He was very upset at the time. He felt that there had been this kind of witch hunt, this hysteria at the time about what had happened in Birmingham. He left the country, he said, partly because of that. He went to live in South Africa. And he said that he thought that there were individuals at the time had obviously not told all the truth. He said he'd had conversations with individuals who'd been involved in the investigation of the outbreak, who said, well, you know, probably people weren't speaking clearly, that someone, that one individual was perhaps holding things back. And he didn't accept the pox and the ducks theory at all. But he was puzzled by this puzzle, which still stands there now, which is, why of all the people in that medical school was Janet Parker singled out as the one that caught smallpox? And more puzzling still, if we accept that the previous outbreak in the 1960s had originated in the lab, why did that also strike a photographer? Out of all the people that could have been struck down by that smallpox outbreak. Keith puzzled over that a lot. He said he was questioned at the time, well, why would it strike photographers more than anyone else? And he couldn't come up with an explanation. He thought about it. He thought, well, actually they're handling all these developer agents and these might dry out their skin. And if they had particularly dry skin, that might make them more susceptible to picking up the virus through the skin. it may be not even a visible abrasion, but just a dry area on their skin, that might account for why the two photographers were at risk. Personally, though, I tend to think that the explanation for Brian Escott Cox, this custom of wandering around and taking orders, maybe that explained it equally well. As the photographer in the medical school, she was responsible for ordering all the photographic material. The academic year, the financial year for the medical school, ended at the end of July, and therefore she tried to empty her budget and buy people material. And therefore she went to the lab. And I said, well, hang on, if that's true, why did it not come out in the shooter report? Why did nobody volunteer this information? And why did nobody volunteer this information in the court case? Why didn't these people say about this? Were they trying to hide things? And he said, well, they wouldn't say this. Because if they said this, they would implicate themselves, or whoever she met in the lab, and they would implicate Janet Parker. She had broken the rules. She had gone through all these signs that said don't go forward. Under the Health and Safety at Work Act, employees have a responsibility for their own health, and they are supposed to comply with the safety requirements of the job. And if she had not done that, they would have been dropping her in it and saying that she was guilty. And whoever opened the door and let her in, if they let her in or whatever they did, they would have been guilty. It was clear to him, as a man who'd spent his life working with criminals, that the average person, even normal, ordinary people, don't incriminate themselves. They're not going to necessarily drop themselves in it, and out of a sense of loyalty, they're not going to drop their colleagues in it. So, Janet was dead, Henry Bedson was dead. What would have been gained by saying, well, she brought it on herself, or that she went there herself, or something like that? And that was very interesting, that take of things, that his view was that we're all kind of fallen individuals. We're all made from this, what was it? Kant called it the warped wood of humanity. Brian actually was quite clear that, yeah, don't expect the truth to have come out unless it was really sought out of individuals by cross-examination by an expert lawyer. It wasn't just going to bubble up to the surface. I'm afraid the problem is that we are not going to come up with a clear explanation after all these years that satisfyingly takes into account both outbreaks and neatly explains them all in a very clear-cut way. One of the things that became clear to me, though, as I was writing the book, was when you look into lab-acquired infection, probably most cases of laboratory-acquired infection, there's no one incident where you can say, ah, that's when it happened then. And I think that is the case here. We're not going to know. She went in the lab, she put her hand on that bench, or she touched that thing. The fact that she probably went to the lab, I think on the balance of probabilities, that's more likely than not. Brian is careful to point out that what he heard was a rumour, but it was a strong rumour, and there is a coherence, there's a rationale to explain why she would have went to the lab, buried in that inside that rumour, and I think that's as good as we're going to get with this, really.
So it's now 40 years since the last smallpox death, and Janet Parker has gone down in medical history. There have been no cases ever anywhere in the world since that time. But the threat of smallpox remains with us, although the disease is gone, because it's still kept in just a couple of laboratories in the world for research purposes. Now, of course, the chances of it ever leaking are remote, but then again, people thought that about the lab in Birmingham too. And significantly, just in the last 12 months, there's been another development. Microbiologists have managed to recreate the horsepox virus, and horsepox is very closely related to smallpox. And it's now possible to create from scratch, in a laboratory, the smallpox virus. And so therefore, although it's unlikely that anybody would, and very few people have the skill, it's not impossible. There's a possibility that it could happen. And therefore, the threat of the virus is actually more realistic than it has been for a good many years.
In May 2014, the World Health Assembly met in Geneva to debate the destruction of the world's last known stockpiles of the variola virus, which causes smallpox. It was clear that opinion was divided. Should the smallpox kept in secure laboratories in both Russia and the USA be destroyed, thus preventing their use as an infectious agent in the future, or kept to ensure that the genetic material is available to scientists and researchers for the development of antivirals and vaccines?
After the eradication campaign and after the events in Birmingham, there was a worldwide effort to identify and destroy all the stocks of smallpox virus, or to consolidate them in the two places where they're currently kept. Once that had to be completed, the question then arose, well, why do we need to keep them? And this has been revisited several times, and each time there's been a stay of execution. People say that, well, we need to do more research. What if smallpox did reemerge? Whether it reemerged from somewhere, naturally, or, you know, no foul play, or whether there wasn't bioterrorism or biowarfare incident that meant that smallpox reemerged, then we would at least have to have done research on it, and we'd be able to do research on it and so forth. I think the lesson from Birmingham, there is a risk of laboratory-acquired infection, and that once an illness has been eradicated in a society, the laboratory becomes the major reservoir and is a big risk. And if you want to take that risk down to zero, then just get rid of it in the laboratory.
Well, the fact that we eradicated it was due to the weaknesses of the virus, in the sense that it doesn't get around all that easily, although you might think it can after the Birmingham incident, but it's quite hard for the virus to get about. It doesn't live in any animals, it's not out there, it doesn't last too well in the environment, it's not in a water supply, it only grows in people, and it's not particularly tough. It's quite different from some other things that, you know, maybe you'd consider to be rather similar, like anthrax, for example, which is a bacterium, but that has spores which can last 100 years in the environment, whereas smallpox cannot last 100 years in the environment. It might last a few years on the very most optimal circumstances, like in the permafrost, for example. But it's going to be enfeebled, and it's not going to be a survivor under those circumstances. And, you know, basically, we haven't had any smallpox since the 1970s, which proves the point, really. There are other bugs which would be much easier to get hold of, which occur in nature, often in countries where terrorism is a pretty common event. And I'm slightly surprised it hasn't been used, although it does need a little bit of technical expertise. But the knowledge is freely available. You just go into a medical school library and you read out how to weaponize bugs. I won't tell you which ones, but it's all there. If you knew about it, you could do it very easily. I don't know how much vaccinia virus vaccine they have. It's very easy to grow. So you could make more if you wanted without any great difficulty. And it's been improved. It's been made less nasty as well. I think the US people have certainly done work on that. So if it was needed, I'm sure there'd be enough there. The people who would need the vaccine would be the carers of any sufferers. It would be probably quite wrong to go out with a mass vaccination program for the population. There might be a demand for it, but, you know, you'd have to manage that very carefully. But basically, it would be sealing off the people who are infected to stop them spreading the virus. It would depend on how the virus had been spread itself, but spraying it into the street, you know, from an aerosol can wouldn't do. It wouldn't infect enough people, I don't think, to cause a vast number of cases. You might get a few.
My personal view is, well, actually, symbolically, eradication, destroying the stocks, getting rid of smallpox, saying it's gone from the face of the planet, that has merit to me. And the argument that we need to do research, well, actually, the antiviral drugs that we might need in the future, you can do that research on related viruses. It seems to me very far-fetched that we're going to come up with a drug that works really, really well against smallpox, but doesn't work against vaccinia, the various rodent poxes and monkeypox and whatever. That seems to me unlikely. And similarly the other way round, if we got a drug that works well against vaccinia, then I think you can pretty much generalise it's going to work against variola as well. I have named my book The Last Days of Smallpox. Some people have said, well, you're making yourself hostage to fortune there because it might come back.
I'm of the school that perhaps think we should just hang on to at least one lab with some vials of the virus. The argument against that is, well, we don't need it. And the arguments against it is that some ill-considered person, a terrorist or something like that, might get some virus, bribe somebody in the lab and get the virus, grow it up and use it as a weapon of biological warfare. Well, it wouldn't be a very good weapon for biological warfare, but it would create mayhem and panic. So you could get rid of that by getting rid of the virus. But if you get rid of the virus altogether, I think in the fullness of time we will. Because we can sequence the DNA of the virus, you can actually, in theory, you could recreate the virus without too much difficulty. But it wouldn't be quite the same, and you might miss a trick on that. So I think, you know, basically one lab perhaps, but not two, but then politics, it's all politics. It's not going to go on the rampage, let's put it like that. As soon as you knew what it was, you could nip it in the bud. But the civil disorder that would happen would be quite substantial. People would be queuing up for vaccine. And what we learned when we had outbreaks in the UK was that, generally speaking, when that happened, when there was an outbreak, usually quite a small one, handful of cases, often focused on a hospital, a few cases in the community, more people died of vaccination than died of the smallpox. So it could be coped with very straightforwardly, but the pandemonium of panic would be basically the harm that would be done by it. Just like any bioterrorist thing, you know, it would have enormous sort of publicity, and the population would be quaking with fear because people are afraid of infection, because it can strike you just out of the air. It's not like bombs and bullets even.
Mark Palin again.
The motivation for bringing it back, I find that hard to fathom. If you wanted to create havoc in a society, there are easier ways to do it than using smallpox. We have a vaccine against smallpox. If you wanted to build the virus from scratch, it's quite hard to make smallpox. Someone has done it with horsepox and shown that, yes, you could make a virus like this. It'd be a lot easier to make Ebola virus or influenza virus. These are much smaller viral genomes. If you wanted to create havoc, you know, you could take the 1918 pandemic influenza virus and create trouble with that. But you wouldn't even need to go that far. I mean, there are viruses that are used that we know work using gene therapy. You could take one of those and put a nasty, you know, put a toxin gene in there, and that would create havoc. So I think the motivations for going to all the trouble to make smallpox again in the lab, I don't buy it, I don't see it. It's very unlikely.
In the United States in 2014, a government scientist cleaning out an old storage room at a research centre near Washington discovered decades-old vials of smallpox packed away and forgotten in a cardboard box. The 6 glass vials of freeze-dried virus were intact and sealed with melted glass, and the virus might have been dead. Still, the find was disturbing. If it happened once, who is to say it won't happen again? Andy Richards from the Birmingham Mail.
40 years on from the smallpox outbreak in Birmingham, by a strange quirk of fate, the World Health Organization's top man on variola virus was in Birmingham. He was a guest speaker at the Microbiology Society annual conference. It attracted thousands of delegates from around the world. And one of the guest speakers was Geoffrey Smith, who's head of pathology at Cambridge University and chair of the World Health Organization Advisory Committee for Variola Virus. I thought it was important to try and grab a word with him if I could, and I was fortunate he managed to talk to me in a lunch break. And I asked the professor why it was important to still retain smallpox and what kind of things were being done with the virus. And he said that research was being carried out to create new diagnostic tests so that if ever smallpox did re-emerge, tests could be made rapidly and quickly to specifically identify the disease. And the other reason is to make a new and safer vaccine. There was always a danger with the old one. Some people reacted very badly to it. But the new modern vaccine would be able to be used in all people, in all circumstances. Finally, I asked him about the news that it is now possible for synthetic biologists to create smallpox from scratch in a laboratory. And he said that it would require a sustained and deliberate effort to do so, but it would be possible. But did he think it was likely to happen? No, he thought it was most unlikely. But he did make one more comment, and it's a very sobering one. He told me, "The possibility that smallpox virus can be made means the threat of smallpox virus can never be eradicated."
One of the things that comes out of the Birmingham episode is, well, why would you put a smallpox lab into the middle of a building in the very middle of a big campus with lots of people coming and going, and put that campus right in the middle of a big city? That seems a bit mad. And actually what happened in the UK was all this kind of research got consolidated into Porton Down, which is in the middle of Salisbury Plain, a long way from anywhere else. Okay, it's fairly close to Salisbury, but, you know. And where is the smallpox now? Well, it's sitting in the middle of CDC in Atlanta, Georgia, in a very busy, big city. So if it did escape from the lab, that's not a great place for it to be. What about the Russian stocks? Russia isn't showing itself to be a particularly trustworthy state entity currently. You know, them sitting there, I'm not sure that's a great thing. I think we can trust our colleagues in CDC and our American colleagues that they're not going to do anything naughty, but I don't know. So I would feel much more comfortable if both sets of stocks were destroyed and that were the end of it.
When Mrs. Parker was dying, there was one word on her lips, and she repeated it over and over, and the word was shame. Shame, shame, shame. So what did this dreadfully ill woman mean? Was it a shame for her? Was it a shame for the university? Was it a shame for the doctors who were looking after her? I don't think it meant any of those things. I think it relates to the way in which she caught the disease. Because Brian Escott Cox, the QC who defended the university, has a theory. And the theory is this, that if the smallpox didn't go to Mrs. Parker, Mrs. Parker must, in some way, have gone to the smallpox. And there was a rumour at the time that she was in the habit of providing film and photographic material to her friends who were going on holiday. And I think that it's more likely that she visited someone who had a connection with the laboratory to deliver some film and somehow picked up the disease that way. Someone who probably was vaccinated and covered themselves, whereas she wasn't properly protected. And when she was saying the word shame on her deathbed, I think what she meant was this, was that it was a shame that an innocent good turn done to help someone out had ultimately brought about what happened to her and was going to result in her death. Of course, we'll never absolutely know. It may be in some ways that it's better that we never absolutely know what happened. Because if we did, by nature, we can be complacent. And I think it's a very dangerous thing to be complacent with smallpox. If there's one thing that I've learnt after looking at this case for several years, you can't be complacent with smallpox. You can never turn your back on it. You can never take it for granted. It's too wily a disease to do that.